We're going to go to a couple of our reporters out at campaign headquarters. David Hyde is at the Ed Murray campaign headquarters. Hello, David.
Hey, Steve.
We heard the big shouting. What are people telling you?
Shouting's still happening. The music's still happening. Murray supporters in this crowd were really excited earlier just after the initial wave of votes were released, 56-43. People seem to be feeling pretty good about this result. I talked to a bunch of volunteers and folks here earlier saying the key word for them is change. And, of course, there's a lot of enthusiasm for Senator Ed Murray as the person who basically helped get R-74 passed. That's the ballot initiative for same-sex marriage. Also spoke to the bartender who tells me he's serving a lot of vodka drinks.
Vodka drinks have to mean something. All right, David, thanks a lot.
All right, bye, Steve.
Take care. Deb Wong is at the Mike McGinn headquarters. Hello, Deb.
Hey, Steve.
Are they serving vodka or something, I don't know, even doubles? Doubles to drown their sorrow?
I'm not sure, but I think people are pretty much crying into their drinks right now. This is Mike McGinn took to the stage a few minutes ago. He did not concede the race, but he all but conceded, saying that this is not where we wanted to be, and we know we'll be calling Ed Murray at some point in the next near future. So, pretty much a concession speech, even though it wasn't a concession speech. And when those numbers came over, there's a big screen TV in the middle of the bar where we are. The numbers came out. There was really just quiet in the room, sort of stunned silence. People, even though McGinn has been down in the polls all this time, people were really hopeful that he was that he would have at least pulled within a few percentage points of Murray, and that perhaps a late surge of voters could have put him over the top. So I think there was just real disappointment that he didn't even get close tonight.
Deb, is there any time given for when Mike McGinn may come out and offer a concession speech?
I'm guessing he's going to sleep on it and then maybe wait till tomorrow. But it's not going to be long. It's a 13-point spread between the two men. It's going to be, I would say it's impossible to make up that spread from anyone's perspective. So I suspect it's going to be pretty soon that he'll come out with that concession speech.
All right. Deb Wong at the Mike McGinn headquarters. We also heard from David Hyde at the Ed Murray headquarters. Greg Nichols is two-term mayor of Seattle. He joins us in the studios. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be here.
Rob McKenna is a two-term attorney general. He joins us in the studios. Good to see you.
Well, you know, we're both really famous for being on the county council.
That's where we made the most trouble.
They both served together on the county council. Is Deb Wong right? Is that deficit for Mike McGinn too big to make up?
Yes, it is. And it's not a shock by any means, because as you pointed out, the polls have been showing Ed Murray with a substantial lead. But it's still, I think, somewhat striking. In the last 25 years, the voters of Seattle have only reelected a mayor on two occasions, in 1993 and in 2005. And, you know, obviously this one hits pretty close to home for me, having served in that office. It's a tough job. It's particularly tough, I think, for someone like Mayor McGinn, who came in without previous experience in office. There's a long learning curve. And, you know, I think that tonight's outcome is as I said, not a surprise. Ed Murray is going to find that the city and how it works is very different than the legislature and the vast experience that he has there. But he does come in with experience as an elected official, understanding how government works, how to make it work. And so he'll have a different set of challenges, I think, than Mayor McGinn did 4 years ago.
So, Rob McKenna, you worked with Mike McGinn sometimes.
Yeah.
What happened to Mike McGinn that gave him a 13-point deficit at this point? Percentage point deficit, Ed Murray.
Well, I think part of it was style. He was unorthodox. That, I think, didn't sit well with people who thought they wanted a non-politician as mayor.
Right, that's what people say.
Exactly. And this has happened before. We had a mayor named Schell who was a non-politician, and he was a one-termer. I think as mayor, everything comes to roost on your doorstep. As Greg knows, when you're in an executive role, for better or for worse, you know, it's what happens, right? And even the, you know, Greg, who many people now are thinking of very, very fondly as their mayor, because it's always like, you know, it's always with retrospect you really appreciate a good public servant. I think that they decided to try something new with Mayor McGinn. And I personally worked with him quite well on some issues like human trafficking, but he just didn't sit well with the average voter who decided, after all, we want someone more conventional.
You know, at one point I thought maybe he wasn't sitting well with the downtown interests. I put that in quote.
Mm-hmm.
And with some of the establishment. I put that in quote. But as Rob McKenna says, this is about not sitting well with a lot of voters.
It is.
Was it a successful message, or was he really
out
of sync?
That Ed Murray's message was very simple. He said, "I'm not Mike McGinn."
Yeah.
And that was enough of a message. Usually with an incumbent and with a decent economy, you have to make the case why that elected official should be fired. In this case, the public had apparently already gotten there because his numbers never moved. He had a good campaign. I think it was a very smart campaign, and his numbers just never moved. And so I think the people had made up their minds, and once they were given a plausible alternative, credible public servant as an alternative, they said, yep, that's where we're going to go.
Take 20 seconds here. Do you agree with that? Credible public servant?
I agree that it was too far behind at the beginning of the election to really ever catch up. There's nothing that Mayor McGinn could do to really move the numbers in his favor. So Senator Murray adopted the very, very intelligent strategy of focusing on winning the primary. And he did that by lining up a lot of key groups and a lot of key endorsements early on. And the other I'm Not McGinn candidates to split the vote among themselves. And Ed came through. He's a very experienced politician and knows how to do that.
All right. We're going to come back to this conversation with Rob McKenna and Greg Nichols, but we're going to come back to that conversation. But let me turn to some of the statewide measures, and let's start with the 522 concerns labeling of genetically engineered foods. Austin Jenkins is at the Yes on 522 headquarters. Hello, Austin.
Good evening.
What's the sense of things at their headquarters?
Well, you know, right now they're about 8 points down with, I think, about 900,000 votes having been tallied. That's about half the universe of ballots that will probably be cast in this election. And the proponents have just started giving speeches, and they sound like they are resigned to the fact that a win, eking out a win, will be unlikely. They are spinning this as if this fight goes on, but success may have eluded them here tonight as it did in California 1 year ago.
Whatcom King Jefferson is where the Yes was leading. In every other county, it was going down to defeat Stevens. I'm not sure what's happening in Stevens. No election results at this time. But
we don't know how the two votes in Stevens came in yet.
but Austin, the Yes people are trying to spin it as maybe a success, but they were outspent.
Nearly 3-1 outspent. And they are casting this as a David versus Goliath fight. It is true that when you are talking about an issue like GMOs that was not on the radar of many voters, I think 6 to 8 weeks ago, many Washington voters would have been hard-pressed to define what GMO stands for, that they had an uphill battle to present a complicated subject and a possible, as they viewed it, solution, and then be up against a pretty simple message from the opponents who had unlimited cash and blanketed the airwaves.
All right, Austin Jenkins at the Yes on 522 campaign right now. Thank you, Austin. Right now, no is at almost 55%, and yes is at about 45%. I want to link this to another money measure, which was the Seattle money measure, to come up with some funds for public candidates. What did you make of this, of the amount of money that was spent in this campaign, Rob McKenna? I mean, was that the deciding factor?
Yeah, it was a staggering amount of money. And actually, it was part of a pattern in this election of 2013 of a staggering amount of money coming into a variety of races, not just the ballot measures, but other races as well, from outside interests. We saw it happen in the special election for the state Senate seat in the 26th district. We saw it happen with Initiative 522. There was a record amount of independent money in the mayor's race, as a matter of fact, as the Seattle Times reported. So in that sense, it was part of a pattern. And of course, it's not surprising that it happened with the with 522 because GMOs have been a big battle in other states as well. And because this was the state which was the battleground this year, all of the attention came here, just like was it last year in California, where a similar measure went down. So naturally, stakeholders on both sides invested a lot because they know if they win here, or on the other hand, defeat the measure here, it really helps you know, prevent it or help it pass in other states, depending.
They spent a lot of money, and they followed a pattern in the ads, it seems to me, that were similar to the money that was spent on the sugar tax or
The soda pop tax.
The soda pop tax, right. Yeah. Throw a lot of stuff up there to get the voter maybe to doubt what they're seeing, and that's a successful campaign. Or did they have a good message, the no people?
Well, obviously they had a good message in that they were successful in defeating this initiative, but I would predict that it will not be the last battle. You know, we've seen that with a lot of other issues. It'll come forward once, twice, be defeated. More voter education takes place that then offsets some of the huge dollars that are spent in the last weeks of a campaign. So this is one I think we're going to see again in the legislature. I think we may see again on the ballot, both here and in other states. And my guess is that at some point we'll have some kind of a system for identifying these items and informing the consumer of them.
I think that may happen. It could happen voluntarily. If the market decides that this is something voters or consumers want to know about, then they'll respond accordingly. In fact, it already exists to the extent that you can go out and buy organic food that's labeled correctly as being organic, and know that it doesn't contain GMOs. And that was a reason that I decided not to vote for 522, because I figured, well, where it matters to me on certain products, I know all I need to do is buy certified organic food, and it's not going to contain GMOs.
Maybe this is a gimme, but was it an overreach for you to have the government being asked to put up a labeling system like this?
No. Labels can be really valuable. I mean, I really appreciate the fact there's nutritional information on packaging, but it's on the back, and it's information I can actually do something with. To me, simply saying contains genetically altered ingredients or GMO doesn't really tell me that much, because I know that a great deal of food, corn and soybeans and others, have been genetically modified in ways that are completely benign, except that they help produce healthier plants that are more disease resistant, that they're benign to me for my health. So to me, it was no more important for me to know whether the corn was genetically modified than it would be to know if it was grown in Kansas versus Iowa. It just doesn't matter that much.
You think we'll see it again, though, don't you?
I do think we'll see it again. I think it's a debate that will take place not just here in Washington State, obviously, but nationally.
One other thing, though, about it, Steve, I agree with you, Greg. It's coming back, if not here in other states. But I was interested in the fact that, aside from the advertising, when you look at people who are really, really thoughtful and pay attention and read this stuff carefully, and I'm thinking of, you know, editorial board members, it was really striking to me the number of editorial boards that came out against 522, including the editorial board of the Olympian. I don't think this is an ideological thing. Liberal newspapers, more conservative editorial boards united around opposing it. They felt that it was misleading. And the second point I would make is, let's give the voters a little credit here. They're not automatons. It's not just about how many TV ads are run. I mean, I think people had a chance to look at the information, and they decided I'm not convinced this is really important enough to do it. And so what I mean by that is the pro 522 people apparently didn't make their case beyond just saying you should have a right to know. I think people wanted to know, and you have a right to know what exactly, and why is that worth the cost?
Yeah, we had arguments about that too. Did they make the right arguments? Let me turn to one more race out there. The Sawant Conlon race, City of Seattle, position 2. Amy Radel is there. Richard Conlon has got 53% of the vote, and Shama Sawant has 46% of the vote. Amy Radel, that's a pretty good showing for Sawant.
For a socialist, she definitely felt. She said it was Eugene Debs' birthday today. She announced at the party here on Capitol Hill, and she said this was a fitting tribute to him, just for a socialist candidate to do as well as she did in this race. She didn't concede. She's expecting her results to maybe even improve by a couple points as the count goes on. She wasn't saying, she didn't seem to really think that there's a chance for her to still win this seat, but she expects her results to improve, and she is full of plans for the future. I think she's going to stay on the political scene here regardless of what happens tonight. She's talking about running again. She's talking about bringing a working-class slate of candidates up against the Seattle City Council the next time around, and maybe having a ballot measure for a minimum wage ballot referendum in Seattle along the lines of SeaTac. And the people here were thrilled with the SeaTac results with the minimum wage there. So they're feeling like there's a lot of good news tonight, even if her showing is maybe not over the top.
All right, Amy Radel, I appreciate that. That's very interesting that she sees herself as having gotten enough response, that she's going to keep going.
And I think that isn't at all a unrealistic. She has made a very strong showing for a first-time candidate of any political persuasion against a long-time and relatively popular incumbent. The fact that she ran openly as a socialist, I think, both helped and hurt her. It helped identify her with some issues that were different than her opponent, probably also scared off some voters who thought, oh, my goodness, where are we headed with that? But she's one of the complaints, I think, about Seattle city government is that it's too monochromatic, that too many of the candidates believe virtually the same thing. Mm-hmm. And in the past, were all elected by the same electorate citywide. And I think that she brought a different viewpoint than we have seen in the major candidates for Seattle City Council. That was valuable, and I think and I hope to see more from her.
And there's an interesting point. As Amy Radel mentioned, the city of SeaTac proposition number one, a $15 minimum wage. Yes, 53%, almost 54%. The no's at 46%. At the same time, the initiative or the amendment to create a public financing in the city of Seattle, that seems to be going down. But the district elections is looking like it may. We have to get the final results, but it's, at this point, it's leading. What does a Republican take from these interesting sort of results?
That's a hard pattern to discern. Let me comment on the districting election.
Please.
First of all, you know, Greg and I, we were mentioning earlier, both served on the county council, and it worked very well, really well for us because the county is a diverse enough place that it makes sense to have council districts, and we both worked hard to represent, you know, in my case, part of East King County, in Greg's case, you know, West Seattle, Vashon Island. You went south to Des Moines, that area.
Burien.
Yes, uh-huh. And it made sense to have council districts. Well, the city of Seattle is a pretty diverse place, too. And I think that there are probably enough voters in enough neighborhoods that felt like they aren't getting enough particularized attention, enough personalized attention, that they'd like to have a council member for their area of the city. And given the size of the city, it's not all that remarkable to think they might be elected by district. So, you know, like Greg said, that some ideas come back more than once. This idea has been on the ballot, what, three times before?
Oh, at least, yeah.
And has lost, but maybe it was just time because the city's gotten big enough and neighborhoods have gotten well-organized enough and sophisticated enough to know they might be better off having someone from their area as their representative.
I mean, the yeses are at 64% now, the noes at 35%.
For district elections.
For district elections.
That's a pretty remarkable turnaround compared to last time, right, Greg?
Well, and maybe the biggest harbinger of that was the Seattle Times, which for 100 years has opposed it. Came out and editorialized in favor of it. So I think Rob's right. People felt it was time. And it will change the nature of city elections. They'll be less expensive. Shoe leather will be valued more because the districts will be of a size that you could actually meet many of the voters. And I think it'll be a good thing. And two of the members of that nine-member council will be at large. So you'll be balanced between districts. Every part of the city will have a voice, and then a couple of members who will.
And it might make it more likely that the socialist candidate will win in the future, I suppose, depending on the district, right? I
mean,
I
probably that. Fremont.
And why would you pick Fremont, comrade?
The financing looks to go down. It was a little confusing, but the idea that the SeaTac one wins, Ed Murray and some of the city council members say they're going to follow up on that. So we'll see how that plays along in this. All right, Greg Nichols and Rob McKenna. That was short and sweet, but we made it happen.
For the record, I'm the sweet one.
I appreciate you both helping us do this. Andy Hurst engineering, Jason McGanna producing this. Oh, all sorts of people to thank, and we thank them, Amy Radel, David Hyde, and Austin Jenkins, Deb Wong, and all the KUOW folks. Check out our webpage. We'll have more results and more stories tomorrow morning and on the record. This is KUOW Seattle.